This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Stop and think about the kinds of real talk we've had in the past few months when it comes to visibility and equity. The publishing paid me hashtag revealed how black writers have been paid smaller advances for their books and their white peers. The open letter, We See You, American Theater, has detailed how the work of people of color has been minimized in that industry. Vanity Fair just hired its first ever black photographer to shoot a cover. And last night, Joy Reid became the first black woman to host her own primetime show on cable news. In her new book, Tiffany D. Cross examines how black voices and issues important to black communities are often overlooked or excluded from the media and how that shapes our political discourse and can influence who gets elected. Say It Louder, Black Voices, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy is part memoir and part analysis. Tiffany is a Spring 2020 Fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, and having worked at CNN, BET News, and then launching a news platform of her own, The Beat DC, she's seen firsthand how narratives about candidates, campaigns, and world events are crafted and reinforced. Tiffany, welcome to All of It.
Allison, I'm so excited to be with you today. I am such a fan of yours, long time, just a fan of all the work at NPR. So I'm just excited to be here, and thanks for having me. It should be a robust discussion because you just listed off some very historic things that happened. Number one being Joy Reid making history as a black woman taking up primetime space on cable news. Long overdue, but happy to see it happen.
So let's dive in. So when we talk about, when you hear people on cable news talk about the black vote, as if it's just this one big giant black vote, how does that end up minimizing the role that black Americans play in our elections?
Well, it has a huge adverse impact because when you read in newspapers and hear across the cable news echo chambers, people say things like college-educated white men or non-college-educated white women. And then when it gets to us, like you said, they simply say the black vote, as if we don't disaggregate in that same way. White voters are also given cute little nicknames, like you have NASCAR dads and soccer moms, as if we couldn't have nicknames that apply to black people. And so, but we're never afforded those colloquialisms. Mm-hmm. And so I think because the media has such a narrow view of what the black experience is like, that white media gatekeepers tend to intentionally or unintentionally bleach the American experience. And so much of what we know about our politics, Allison, is filtered through the media landscape. And so when that landscape looks not like America, there are not a lot of diverse editorial decision makers or diverse people with editorial decision making power, it casts a dark shadow across our democracy. And there are several examples I go through in my book, Say It Louder, that punctuate the point that you cannot leave out the rising majority of the country when talking about politics and policy and every political conversation. Until very recently, every political conversation in the mainstream media centered white people. And I think we're at a moment in time where that's just no longer acceptable. And I think the media landscape has realized that they will get left behind as long as they continue to do that. Although some of the attempts to correct that, I think, has been a missed opportunity. There are some outlets to say, oh, now we're going to have a race editorial team, and they still treat us as though we're the side dish. And I know I'm not a French fry, and you don't look like a mashed potato, so they have not yet caught up that the rising majority is no longer the side dish. We're very much a part of the mainstream, and it doesn't have to be a separate vertical, but has to be integrated across all platforms, across multi-platform coverage in every way possible.
Yeah, the idea is weave it into the fabric of who you are and what you do.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be a thing. It just is.
Exactly.
What's a news story or a political story that you think could have been covered or told in a different way? I know there are many, but if you can just pick out one.
Yeah. How much time do we have? Sure. I would say, I think not covering police brutality really was another thing to cast a wide net of influence on our democracy. So this touched on a lot of things. So imagine had we been covering police brutality since inception. But let's just start with, you know, when I was in when I was a teenager with the Rodney King shooting. That, you know, was a blip. It came and it went, although police brutality still continued. You start with the Michael Brown shooting when the DOJ began investigating Michael Brown's death. they uncovered a system where police had been directed to generate revenue for the city's budget by harassing Black people, by using fines, fees, and other tactics targeting the working class Black people in a city where the median household income was $41,000 a year. And so a single missed payment or a late payment or a partial payment could potentially mean jail time for impoverished people. So essentially people were funding a system that was oppressing them and bleeding them dry. But the only way we found out about this was this blood sacrifice, was the murder of Michael Brown. Imagine if white women in Beverly Hills or in Bethesda, Maryland, had been getting pulled over and targeted by police to fund a tax revenue system. It would be major breaking news across all networks, yet it wasn't. When the media, after the shooting of Trayvon Martin, began to cover briefly police brutality, we saw a direct impact on democracy. We saw an election, a sweeping election of Black female prosecutors elected. You saw Marilyn Mosby unseat a five-year incumbent. You saw Kimberly Fox in Chicago. You saw, I don't want to mess up her name, Ariana Fox, I think is her name in Florida. Forgive me if I'm getting these names wrong. But the point is there were tons of women across the country. I get all their names right in the book. But there are tons of Black women across the country who started to have a say in how our unforgiving criminal justice system treated Black people. And so there are a number of examples where when media gatekeepers don't bleed to the American experience, when this coverage is inclusive, you see the direct impact it has on our policies, on our government. And I think we have to punctuate the point that if this government is truly of the people, by the people, and for the people, we have to force people to recognize that for the people includes us, whether you're comfortable with it or not. And I think we're at a moment right now where the rising majority of this country is demanding that, and they're saying we're not going back.
My guest is Tiffany Cross. The name of her book is Say It Louder, Black Voices, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy. So many news organizations, including WNYC's, struggling with the lack of diversity in newsrooms. So, you know, all of these organizations have come out and said, we want to do better. We're going to do better. Here's maybe a way we might do better. When you think about it, as someone who's been around newsrooms, what do you think is the first step to get past these platitudes and these sort of vague promises?
Yes. So I think we have to get to a place where we're not okay with just a cultural shift. Right now we're seeing a cultural shift, but even the media is punctuating the point that they too will have to adjust this narrative, because the narrative is still white people should allow Black people leadership. White people should allow Black people freedom. White NFL owners should allow Black players to kneel. White NASCAR owners should allow Black drivers to wear Black Lives Matter. Well, that still punctuates a narrative that the power rests solely with white decision makers. And so I'm not satisfied with this cultural shift if we don't see a power shift accompany that. And power concedes nothing without demand. So when it comes to newsrooms, a lot of people are covering an issue that they are helped perpetuating, that the white supremacy that they help practice. And it's okay until we start to demand power. And then it's like, oh, you want my job, or you want to be on equal footing with me. We have to see the editorial decision makers start to look like America. We need to see more Black and brown people in positions of power, and not just in front of the camera. I mean, in terms of executive producers, associate producers, in the C-suite offices, in the executive offices, on the corporate diversity boards or corporate boards, period. Not just doing D&I work, not just diversity and inclusion, but work in every area. And we've already seen, I mean, when you look at the amazing response that Joy Reid got in primetime last night, they were the number one trending topic on Twitter. It was this outpouring of support and celebration. And so diversity often feeds the bottom line. It often improves a company's income. So I would say that the excuse of, well, we don't know where to find people, or we didn't know it was this bad. A lot of people have been telling me that, Allison. They say, gosh, Tiffany, I just had no idea. And I have to say, hey, I'm in my 40s. You're in your 40s. You knew it was this bad. You chose to look the other way. But that's fine. Now that we're in this moment, what are you willing to do about it? And so we have to keep demanding. But at some point, they are going to have to concede some power.
In the book, as I mentioned, it's part memoir. It's your sort of coming of age story, working in news at CNN and Atlanta and DC. And a lot of it is about these kind of assumptions that are made in newsrooms on all levels. So on the people that you're covering and then the people who are doing the covering. Of all the assumptions all right. you've encountered, which one do you think was the most dangerous?
Oh, gosh. That is could be such a long response because I don't know if there is a single one that is the most dangerous, but I will reference something I wrote about in the book, and that's CNN used to have this segment called The Good Stuff. And it's kind of like a feel-good segment at the end of their morning program. And they ran this segment, and it showed a younger, darker-skinned man with locks come into a store. I guess the owners forgot to lock up the store. And he picks out a drink, and he's looking around. Nobody's there to take his money. So he simply takes his money, leaves it on the counter, turns around, holds up the few dollars, leaves it on the counter, and walks out. So CNN aired this as The Good Stuff. I found that incredibly offensive because the assumption was that this young man is the anomaly. Mm-hmm. That, look, hey, everybody, they don't all steal. Would this have been The Good Stuff had he been a white kid with blonde hair in khakis and a polo in a suburban neighborhood? Would they have still aired that to say, this is The Good Stuff? The next week, they followed that up with guys. They were in a parking lot practicing for a wedding. They were doing their dance routine, and some people in the hotel called the cops to complain. They were making a lot of noise, so said the people. A cop shows up, and the guys capture it all on video. He has his body cam, and they're saying, oh, one of our pals is getting married tomorrow. We're doing a dance routine. The cop says, yeah, I'd love to see it. So the guys do the whole dance routine, and incident gone, nothing happens. They aired this segment as The Good Stuff in 2016 at the height of black men getting shot by police. Mm. And I found it so tone deaf. The assumption was, look, black people, good news. All you got to do is do WAP and Diddy and do your five heartbeats dance routine, and you can go home safe that night and don't get shot. These are assumptions that white media gatekeepers make that are incredibly tone deaf to the black experience in this country. So people who've been so historically brutalized, that don't see the humor in this, that don't see the good stuff in this. So that's something in terms of stories, but there have also been assumptions made about me in my time. I think there were assumptions that I just would never be successful in this business or just, you know, dismiss me. I didn't have the protection that a lot of my white female counterparts did. They had godfathers looking out for them, championing them in their careers. They had, you know, uncles who were senators or their parents went to law school as an ambassador who made calls on their behalf to get them jobs at CNN, to get them desk assistant roles at ABC News. I didn't have any of those things. I clawed my way here. So to do that and then show up to a space that was still unwelcoming, that still assumed I was not as smart as the white woman next to me, to still assume that I was incapable of covering Congress or the White House, to still assume that I was incapable of introducing a good story idea or having news judgment, and it created this attitude that maybe this space isn't for you. Maybe you don't belong here. And I had to leapfrog over all of that hate, all of those assumptions, all of the hurdles that were put in my way to still demand my space, to still take up space. And when I'm here, I'm not just here for me. It's the responsibility we all bear. I'm here representing a whole lot about my community, taking responsibility for my community, defining and defending the humanity of my community. Not a lot of other people have that load to bear in their everyday careers, but certainly not in newsrooms.
My guest is Tiffany Cross. The name of her book is Say It Louder, Black Voices, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy. Okay, in our last 2 minutes, I'm going to ask you to put on your analyst hat for me.
Okay.
Is Joe Biden going to pick a black woman for VP? Go.
I certainly hope so. I penned an op-ed with some friends in the Washington Post. It seems that if he wants to win, that would be a winning strategy to pluck someone who disproportionately upholds this country, this democracy, and certainly the Democratic Party. But I just do want to caution, it's not necessarily how black somebody is, but how black are your policies? Are you willing to adopt an agenda that comprehensively addresses issues relevant to the black community? Who on your team can go and have familiarity with these communities and talk to your voting base? And so at times it feels he may be going out of his way to not pick a black woman. So I hope for all the people who are trying to help usher him over this finish line that he makes the job easier with a sound choice of someone who could lead on day one, someone who can excite the voting base, because there are people who are excited about the idea of a 2008 Joe Biden who stood by Barack Obama. But the reality of a 2020 Joe Biden is something very different. And he does need a voting base who look at the historic and great presidency of Barack Obama as their floor and not their ceiling. And so they want to be excited about casting a vote. They don't want to just vote against Trump. They want to vote for something, a vision. And this, you know, kind of lay low and stay in my lane and, you know, appeal to these middle of the road voters, I think, is sometimes how people can become political roadkill. So I hope he picks a black woman.
The name of the book is Say It Louder, Black Voices, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy. Tiffany Cross, thank you for making time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. This was awesome, Allison. Love to be here.